As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, midweek action. The Klopp farewell lap begins with Liverpool doing Chelsea. Meanwhile, in North London, bees join doctors and rail staff in having a quick strike for Mopay. But Spurs walk out the winners. We talk darts, madders and hatters, and hear about the latest upsets in the AFCON. It's all in this Totally Football Show. Greetings, listener, from what we're calling Thursday, the 1st of February. Pinch and the punch, hey, Duncan Alexander?
Jesus. Yeah. I mean, hello.
Woo. Also with us today, alongside Duncan and moi, we've got that Tom Williams. All right, Tom.
Hello, James. Happy end of January.
Yeah. I mean, it's over, isn't it?
It's over. It'll be back, but, you know, we've got time to prepare for the next one.
Yeah. Ooh, and shut the front door. It's Seb Stafford-Bloor.
All right, Jimbo.
Seb. Over from Germany.
Over from Germany for a few days.
Right. Yeah. That's it.
I've enjoyed getting less of my Euros and, you know, not being able to take food back to Germany. Those kind of things.
Yeah, that's so smart.
You can't take it back now.
No, certain products. Dairy, big no-no.
What would you want to take back? What would be top of your list?
Things I miss. My wife misses Walker's Crisps. And other products and other brands that, you know, are available.
But aren't Walker's Crisps available as Lay's Crisps?
No, see, my wife would shout at you for saying this. It's not the same at all. Not the same.
Made in the same place, not?
Not at all.
Okay. We voted leave, Duncan. All right. Get over it.
Yeah.
By the way, if you're watching today's show on our YouTube channel, Totally Football Show, you'll be alarmed at the extraordinary spot I'm wearing on my eye. Keep you posted on the progress of that.
I don't think it's that noticeable.
Do you not?
Yeah. I know what literally, it's like to have, like...
said to me this morning, and he was on the other side of the road.
It wasn't the first thing I said. I did some cursory greetings. How are you?
Look out.
And thank goodness you're wearing your glasses today.
Yeah,
that's,
exactly.
That's what I said.
Exactly. Anyway, all right. Ooh, happy end of January. Happy transfer deadline day, Tom Williams. It's been a quiet window so far. This week, though, Crystal Palace completed the second biggest deal of the window. Second biggest deal. Who was that then? Teenager Adam Wharton from Blackburn for $22 million. That's not the biggest deal. The biggest one was that Radu Dragosin when he went to Spurs at $25 million. Quiet. A quiet transfer window, as I say. Duncan, you've been up at the crack of dawn to chronicle deadline days, comings and goings, which are probably going to be huge, aren't they?
I think there will be a bit of movement today. Yeah. Like, there's a few things in the offing, I think. But yeah, it's been quite. I don't think the window's going to slam shut this year. It's going to just be eased closed.
Okay.
It doesn't really slam shut these days. It's kind of lost its kind of cultural. Its cultural kind of.
Yeah, it kind of peaked what 10 or so years ago.
2011, with the extraordinary Lady Carroll.
Do they still show Big Ben on Sky Sports when it closes in England? Do they still do that?
I think
probably.
So, yeah.
Probably,
will they kind of have a lot more somber chimes
this
year?
Is it a big thing in Germany?
Not really. Like, a couple of broadcasters have tried really hard to make it a big thing. They've even adopted the yellow and they actually call it deadline day in English, which is...
But it's like Lay's compared to our Walkers.
It is very much the Lay's, the Walkers, the kind of the Milka to Cadbury's.
Deadline
it's,
Lay's.
Yeah, no, doesn't, deadline. It doesn't translate well.
Although, here's a little bit of Bundesliga-related transfer news. Nottingham Forest have confirmed the signing of US international Gio Reyna. He's on loan until the end of the season from Borussia Dortmund. He hasn't done much of the football for Borussia Dortmund this season. Seb, any thoughts on what Forest are getting?
Very much a little bit of a mixed bag there, Jimbo, because on form and fully fit, good player, really interesting attacking midfielder slash winger. I think he can bring a bit of creativity and a goal threat to Forest. But like you say, 2 years, he's barely played. Last time I looked, I think he'd played less than 300 Bundesliga minutes in the last two seasons.
Ooh.
And that reflects that he's not even really a consideration at Dortmund. He's well behind all the kind of attacking midfielders there. He has no natural role in midfield. And I know it's a little bit of a cliche, but change of scenery. Change of scenery. There's never been a suggestion that Edin Terzic sees him as a kind of long-term option there. And has very much based, I mean, clearly favours Karim Adeyemi in the kind of the wide right position. Jamie Bynoe-Gittens is becoming a first choice and on the left. Jadon Sancho's there at the moment. Donny Marlin is still there, even though he might move. Mm. So this might not age that well. Duncan, I don't know if you know anything about that.
Where might he be moving to?
Well, if you listen to him anywhere but Dortmund, I think it's really, you know, there was sort of mutterings about Manchester United, which may be a little bit ambitious because I'm not sure he's quite that. I was going to say good, but that isn't necessarily the kind of the prerequisite that it once was.
Because they're shedding, you know, forward players.
They would rather lose a few rather than add a couple. But yeah, Gio Reyna just needs to play, and then we'll see how good he is. But he, not going to do that at Dortmund anytime soon. So
good news. Right.
I mean, if you want tenuous links, he was born obviously in Sunderland because that's who his dad was playing for. And Brian Clough ended his playing career as a hot shot at Sunderland. So
Gio Reyna.
Gio Reyna was born in Sunderland.
Yeah, right, but, okay.
So,
I was picturing a baby Daniel Marlin at this point.
Right.
We visited a lot of places for Sunderland.
I crammed a lot into that little Bundesliga round.
They've had worse.
No, it was lovely. Anyway, there's been midweek action, red hot midweek action. And, of course, there's a big round coming up at the weekend. We've got Maher Mazahi going to tell us all about the extraordinary last eight in the AFCON. But a quick roundup of the results on Match Day 22. Two games still to come Thursday night, but so far, biggest result, no question. Rooten Tooten Luton handing Fancy Dan Brighton a 4-0 thumping on Tuesday. And with Fulham's 0-0 with Everton, that means the Hatters are now out of the bottom three and Everton have dropped back into it. Everton, who this week are having a hearing for their appeal on that 10-point penalty. Another one, of course, is perhaps looming for the Toffees. Elsewhere anyway on Tuesday, there was a 3-1 victory for Newcastle, which saw them becoming the first visiting team in a year, almost, to win at Villa Park in the league. Arsenal beat Forest 2-1 to end their Nottingham hoodoo and push Forest deeper into trouble. Palace, Sheffield United was just as expected, a pretty spectacular affair. 5 goals and a big 3 points for Palace's under-fire manager, Roy Hodgson. Wednesday, Liverpool beat Chelsea 4-1 to stay 5 points clear of Man City and Arsenal. City have a game in hand. They saw off Burnley midweek. Their favourite opponent, I think, statistically?
Yeah.
Yeah. This time it was a comparatively narrow 3-1. The aggregate score over the last 13 meetings now stands at 46-2. So Burnley are coming back in that one.
It's a real comeback story.
Yeah.
Step by step.
Yeah. Also, on Wednesday night, Spurs beat Brentford 3-2 to go back above Villa into fourth, or should I say dart back above Villa into fourth. All right, that's where we're going to begin, the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Aubameyang with the pass to Udogie. A luxury of options either side of him. He's picked out Maddison and still Richarlison! Tottenham are flying now!
All right, let's start with the important stuff. Mopé scored, and then he did a dart celebration. And then he, in case anyone missed it, got Tony alongside him. They did the dart celebration again because there was a player on the field who often does a dart celebration. And then he and Madders had words, and then there was a bit of hands. And then Brennan Johnson did the dart celebration. And then essentially, Madison and Mopé took it outside onto Instagram and had a bit of back and forth and rent-free in your brain and... You haven't won enough games to have your own celebration, etc. Terrific stuff, no?
Knockabout fun, yeah. I mean, it's interesting because Saka did it this season and that went down fine because obviously they're England teammates and I think it was maybe done in the right spirit. Yeah. Whereas I think Neil Mopay might be the most annoying man on earth.
Really?
So do you think there's a threshold for... So Neil Mopay scores, technically correct, but Neil Mopay kind of falls over into the ball and the ball goes in. I feel like there's a sort of... There's a quality of goal threshold you have to exceed if you go down that road with your celebration.
But
I don't
in a
think
way,
you crossed it.
The scrappier and more undeserved the goal, the more enjoyable as a supporter when it comes to, you know, rubbing it in your opponent's faces. Like, obviously, everyone will celebrate a spectacular goal.
Right.
But when you've scored a really scruffy goal, you kind of feel like morally provocation is therefore less justifiable, therefore making it even more enjoyable.
For the shithouse.
For the shithouse.
It's... Yeah. It's
and Neil Mopay is very
territory.
Much the shithouse's shithouse.
Yeah.
But the fact that this isn't the first time that someone has done the Madison Dart makes me think, do other footballers find it particularly annoying?
I don't know, Tom.
That Madison does it? Is it something about him? Or is it just a very
enjoyable
thing to do?
I think it's quite memorable. Like, other players have celebrations, but they might be hard to recreate or even remember in the spur of the moment. But there's something faintly budget about doing a dart celebration.
What would you rather he did?
No, just, I mean, it was okay once or twice, but I think making it your sole celebration feels a little bit...
I think it has to be part of your repertoire.
I think,
like, you could use that. Madison, I prefer it if Madison went with that for a free kick or, like, a long ranger, finds top corner. I don't think, you know, you convert, you know, a nice move that ends in the six-yard box. I don't feel like that's dart worthy or dart appropriate. Not worthy, appropriate is probably the word.
I'm surprised at this. I'm struggling right now to think of goal celebrations that you're going to find more.
Well, Marcus Rashford last season, he pointed to his head for quite a few goals, didn't he? And that that had a sort of elegance to it that I don't think
pointing
pretending your Luke Littler does.
I like when a celebration has a synergy with the player. So like the Filippo Inzaghi celebration. Inzaghi, like, worst technical footballer ever to play for Italy, but just loved scoring goals, right? And so it didn't matter whether, you know, ball hit him in the face and went in or, you know, ricocheted off both knees and, you know, found its way into the net. Celebrates the same way with the same passion. Whereas the dart thing, it's...
Oh, is that it? There's not enough passion in it?
No, don't cast me as a passion merchant there, James Richardson. Don't
so
do that.
So there was a Luca Toni, I'm basically...
Yeah, Emil Heskey.
Was that what that was? That was DJ.
It's like, can you believe this? That's essentially what the gesture was supposed to be. Can you? But I feel like it in sign language, it's kind of I'm giving my brain a wobble.
I thought it was like a DJ.
That was Emil Heskey.
You thought it was what?
I thought Luca Toni was like on the decks, DJ.
No. It was like this is
give your head a wobble.
Yeah, this is outrageous.
Do you remember how Bobby Zamora used the kind of like, he shushed the crowd for about 5 years. He had, I don't know what the origin story of that is, but like, I think he had a bad couple of games when he was at Fulham.
Right.
And then used that as kind of motivation for the next 200 games or whatever. Shushed his doubters in inverted commas.
I mean, nothing will ever beat Eric Cantona when he chipped it in. And he just stands and just surveys his realm. I mean, that's a level that I'm not sure recreating darts.
I don't think Neil Mopay.
No, Neil Mopay, they might be French, but I don't think, they share that.
Does Neil Mopay have his own goal celebration?
He hasn't scored enough goals.
But then,
as James Maddison pointed out.
Yeah. So, it was all very interesting, let's say, and Ange helpfully suggested they get into a UFC cage. That's a goal celebration you'd like to see, no? Anyway, the game. Seb, you have kind of leanings towards that.
I have that
end
affliction.
Of London.
Yes.
So it's pretty dire first half from the home side. That must have left you a little bit concerned?
Yeah, it did, because it seemed, and this is the irony of all the, of Mopay Gate, as we might call it. Brentford played really well. They defended really well. They were Spurs obviously want to be quite vertical with the ball and, you know, move it quickly and incisively with a lot of fluidity and movement. And there was no space at all. They disrupted the pattern of the game, set pieces, throw-ins, every restart took forever. And that was clearly part of the game plan and it worked. And then just before half time, when the kind of the big melee with Madison in there and Richarlison was there and thereabouts, it seemed to energize Spurs. And felt like a little bit of an own goal. Like it's kind of as fun as it is to play the nasty man role. I think there's a line that you can't cross, because if you come across an opponent in front of their own crowd who are a little bit flat, and you know, starting to get a bit moany, and you rile everybody up, you're kind of playing the opposition's
hand.
Was
the Xhaka, Trent Alexander-Arnold thing last season when Arsenal were well on top.
That changed the season.
Yeah. And yeah, Arsenal then embarked on a run of 1,000 draws.
I would also offer you Garnacho away in Istanbul in that infamous Galatasaray match.
Yeah, he, I mean, speaking of misplaced shushes, Alejandro Garnacho has really cornered the market when it comes to shushing people only to then lose. Yeah. So a cautionary tale there for any young shushes out there.
Of the list of crowds that I would shush, that is not very high up the list. Of the list of crowds that I would shush after scoring goal, not particularly high up the list.
Well, Spurs, anyway, did their talking with the football in the second half. 3 goals in 8 spectacular minutes. Was this an Ange halftime tweak?
Yeah, there was, before the game, there's a lot of clamour for Rodrigo Bentancur to play with James Maddison. Tottenham fans have a difficult relationship with Pierre-Emerick Højbjerg because of he's quite conservative with the ball. He's become a little bit, as he tries to adapt to Postecoglou's football, he's playing in a way that he doesn't seem comfortable with. He's not a particularly expressive player. So Bentancur came in and didn't quite work. There wasn't quite, I suppose, producer Charlie and I were talking about this before we started recording, and it was the first time Bentancur and Maddison had played together at Spurs because of injuries, and Maddison's obviously a new player. And under Conte, because Spurs' midfield was such a creative void, Bentancur kind of had to play all three midfield roles at the same time, 6, 8, 10. And this time, I don't know, it feels like they're sort of, they were sort of feeling out their own areas. Is that podcast appropriate?
We'll go with it.
It was a bit too much overlap. There was a bit too much crossing over. And Bentancur came off. Højbjerg came on. And the balance was back a little bit. But then also a little surge of energy from Timo Werner. Brennan Johnson playing very well down the right side as well. So yeah, this was a, not Postecoglou masterclass, but definitely an adjustment that worked really, really well. And managed to blow Brentford away within 20 minutes without actually playing well for much of the game, which is, you know, a little surge of power.
Timo Werner is the first Spurs player to assist in his first two Premier League games since Sergei Rebrov, a long way back.
Ooh, that's a great omen. Fortunate omen.
Yeah.
If it's Spurs' stature after, you can't say fairer than this one. It was the first time, Wednesday night, it was the first time in 5 years that what happened?
Oh, Spurs won without Harry Kane and Son Heung-min playing.
Yep, with either of them in the side. Incredible, no? All that time, they'd never had a win.
It's only 6 games.
All that time, they'd only had 6 games.
Yeah. I mean, which is a massive testament
to... last game against Fulham at Craven Cottage?
Hmm.
Was that... That feels like you should be... Yeah.
With February 2019, yeah.
That's the Harry Winks goal when... Yeah. Fun time.
Wow, yeah. Anyway, 3-2. Ivan Toney got his second in two, actually, since his return to reduce the deficit. But Spurs back into the top four. Above them, meanwhile, it's as you were for Liverpool, Man City and Arsenal. All three of them winning midweek. Liverpool with the fat 4-1 over Chelsea. Liverpool with 7 wins from their last 8 in all competitions. The exception being that draw against Fulham, which saw them through to the League Cup final anyway. They've really been missing Mo Salah.
Well, I think this is... Perhaps the most impressive thing about the performance against Chelsea was that this is a completely different Liverpool. And, you know, after Jurgen Klopp's announcement last week, you know, I think there was quite a lot of focus on the fact that he wanted to make sure that the succession plan was in place before leaving. And you couldn't have much better evidence of that than the way Liverpool are playing at the moment. You look at the team they put out last night, Trent Alexander-Arnold's on the bench. Andy Robertson's on the bench. Obviously, Mo Salah isn't there. It's a brand new midfield three compared to recent seasons. It's a brand new front three. Chelsea were terrible, which, you know, helped. But Liverpool were fantastic. And, you know, on paper, the most striking thing for me was in midfield. You know, Chelsea have got the most expensively constructed midfield pretty much in football history. And Liverpool have got, or, you know, last night at least, Curtis Jones, Alexis McAllister, Dominic Szoboszlai, none of those are players who are really renowned for the defensive side of their game. Chelsea, that midfield should be, if nothing else, like very unpleasant to play against. And Liverpool just completely demolished them. So, yeah, very worrying for Chelsea. very encouraging for Liverpool. And yeah, I think the fact that they're, you know, managing to play this kind of football with a totally different set of players and with key figures like Salah and Alexander-Arnold on the sidelines is, you know, sort of testament to what a great coach Jurgen Klopp is.
Yeah, Conor Bradley, who only made his starting debut less than 2 weeks ago, is already kind of on this accelerated, looking like a kind of mid-career player now. It's remarkable.
It's one of my favourite things in football when you see a young player have a good moment, recognise that he's had a good moment and understand that probably this is going to impact the rest of his career's trajectory. So when he creates that goal for Diego Jota, you see him celebrate privately because he's really nice interception, makes Ben Chilwell look very, very naive, I have to say. It's another part of Chelsea's performance, which is kind of baffling. And you see him celebrate. And every now and again, you get these moments, you think, I've got my chance and I've taken it. And you see him, and you see what it means to a young player, and it's really, really lovely moment.
Which is what Alexander-Arnold did.
Yeah, 100%.
A few years ago, and it obviously opens the possibility of him being able to play in midfield now, but as Tom was saying, he doesn't need to. I mean, they've suddenly got squad strength they probably didn't realise they had, and, you know, it's allowed them to attack with overlapping fullbacks again, which is, it's almost like opponents have been like, well, if Liverpool don't do that anymore, we don't need to worry, and, and lo and behold. But the other thing is, obviously, when Klopp announced he was going, everyone immediately went, ah, when Alex Ferguson did this, Manchester United went rubbish. Mm. But there's probably more examples of teams rallying in this situation, including Liverpool when Bob Paisley said he was going to go and things like that. So, you know, Liverpool are in a really good position, obviously with the caveat that they've got a very tough game on Sunday.
Arsenal on Sunday, we'll touch on that in a second or two. Duncan, I believe you got a stat about Darwin Nunes hitting the post.
Yeah, well, obviously that was the running theme during the game. He's now done it 9 times in the Premier League this season, 11 or 12 overall now, but 4 in one game, including from the penalty spot, which was, I mean, my theory, A, that's a record in recorded Premier League history. Mm. My theory is that he's actually been sent from the future to inform the pundits who, it was quite a trend a few years ago for pundits to sort of say, why is a shot against the woodwork a shot off target? Because you've hit the target, forgetting the fact that the target's actually
within the frame.
Yeah, the frame kind of points where the target is
beyond the frame.
Yeah, and Nunes is doing a great job in that respect because he's rattling.
Emphasising with every woodwork struck.
On that point, I remember covering an England game during Roy Hodgson's tenure, a classic sleepy England home game. And England, I can't remember who they were playing against, but they played very badly. And they'd either had no shots on target or they'd had no shots on target in the second half or something. And in the post-match press conference, someone put this to Roy Hodgson, you know, no shots on target, Roy. That's not a, you know, that's not a great look. And he was like, what do you mean? We hit the post. Is that not a shot on target? And about 40 different journalists all went, no, that's the woodwork is not what you're aiming for.
Good Lord.
But I'm kind of happy that Nunes has this stat all of his own. And it feels very fitting.
Yeah.
I'm sure he will, you know, go on to produce goal-scoring stats.
Almost half a season to really take that
woodwork
hitting.
Yeah, the
and
current
then it can be
level.
Like a trophy. It'll be like an unofficial trophy that Darwin Nunez awarded. It'll be like the kind of anti-Puskas.
The current record in the Premier League is 10 by Robin van Persie in 2011-12, his last season at Arsenal. So when he finishes top scorer. So, yeah, I think will Darwin Nunez hit the post twice more between now and May? I'm saying yes.
Okay.
It doesn't seem to bother him. Like the conversation that goes on around Darwin Nunez doesn't seem to change the way he plays, the way he approaches.
He's grown up in the crossbar challenge era. It's a whole different paradigm.
He may hit the post twice more this weekend when, as you mentioned, Duncan, they take on Arsenal, do Liverpool. Their third meeting, these two clubs, in the last 6 weeks or so, because they had that draw in December, which saw Arsenal staying top of the table at Christmas, actually, and then subsequently Liverpool knocked Arsenal out of the FA Cup at the Emirates. What do you feel about Sunday's game? Arsenal coming off that victory away at Nottingham Forest.
Yeah, it feels like a big one for Arsenal. I mean, it's a big one for Liverpool as well, but in the sense that I think Arsenal's confidence is probably quite fragile at the moment in that, yes, they went at Forest, and I think the manner of the victory will have given them a lot of encouragement in that, as is often the case with Arsenal, they sort of dominated possession but in quite a sterile way in the first half, but then managed to find a different gear and, you know, ended up winning the game reasonably convincingly despite the late goal that Owen Hee got for Forest. had obviously beaten Palace quite comfortably prior to that, but the memory of those defeats over the Christmas period, at home to West Ham, away at Fulham, the defeat against Liverpool in the Cup, which was another game that they dominated pretty outrageously without managing to win, those memories are all quite fresh.
Fresh, yeah.
Whereas Liverpool are on this great run and have proven that, you know, they can win games against decent opposition without a whole host of first-team players. Mikel Arteta is sort of, you know, juggling his squad and moving pieces around. You know, Emil Smith Rowe came into the starting 11 at Forest. He tried Kai Havertz as a false nine and Reece Nelson on the wing for that cup game against Liverpool. And he's just still kind of like tinkering, looking for the right formula. So, yeah, feels like, I mean, an Arsenal win would be pretty massive in terms of proving their title credentials, because I feel like the momentum at the moment is much more with Liverpool.
Right. Well, keeping a close eye on that will be Manchester City, who'll be playing their weekend fixture a day later. They're at Brentford, having done Burnley midweek. Julian Alvarez contributing two goals on his birthday. Rodri got the other. Any other notes about this performance?
Erling Haaland coming back.
Coming off the bench.
Taking an air shot. Ironic cheers. Teammates giggling in the stands, which is quite a nice trope you don't see very often. It's kind of like he's so good that it doesn't matter that this is going to go on social media. It's a really nice touch.
But not only an air shot, an air shot that sent the ball backwards.
Yeah.
You know, occasionally you see someone who'll drag a shot badly wide. You might occasionally see a shot that goes out for a throw-in, which, you know, generally provokes a degree of mirth. But for, you know, the greatest centre-forward currently in activity to have a shot that goes literally backwards was quite amusing.
Very nice. They'll be facing Brentford, as I mentioned, on Monday. And then again, in just under 3 weeks' time, because that's their game in hand.
And Brentford did the double again over them last year. So
good Lord.
But City have now won 8 in a row, if you include the Club World Cup. And it's like, you always get to a point in the spring where you're like, whoa, Man City have just won 46 games in a row. And you don't quite realise till it's too late. But I think we're in the very nascent rumblings. Yeah. And that's why I think, In some ways, Arsenal should roll over for Liverpool on Sunday, because you know, Arteta knows that Klopp's going and Pep might be gone soon, so he's got free rein at title challenges. So if we want City to, you know, not become the first team to win 4 in a row and kind of, you know, semi-turn English football into the SPL, then
I expect that will not be clipped up and taken out of context.
do you feel that Sunday's clash at the Emirates is that key in the title race?
I think if Arsenal win or it's a draw, then it really lets City back in.
Well, yeah.
Whereas I think Liverpool can just maintain this gap ahead of their game with City, then they know that even a draw at home to City it keeps them in the box seat.
And City have to go still to Anfield.
Yeah.
And get something. Word of appreciation for the Kevin De Bruyne assist for Julian Alvarez's second goal, which was, it was like, I don't know, like curling or like, you know, crown green bowls in that Burnley are lining up to defend a free kick. City have obviously worked on this in the training
like
ground.
David
Alvarez
Jack
is going to spin in into the space. And De Bruyne, I mean, could not have placed it more precisely. And that was very enjoyable.
Like do you remember the Zanetti goal in 98 against England? And the kind of like you have all these skilled, like, you know, about a dozen different really gifted number 10s around the ball. And then naturally, as a defence, you're not going to pay attention to the guy drifting off behind the wall and it's Zanetti. So, you know, it's really nice. It's really nicely constructed.
Wout Weghorst.
Wout Weghorst, yes.
So much
absolutely.
So,
yeah. One of the greatest trick free kicks of all time. There's a very good YouTube compilation. I've probably not watched it for about 10 years, so it may no longer be there, but it's called something like Great Trick Free Kicks. Nice. And it's just clever free kick routines with like a thumping soundtrack.
Does it have some kind of happy disco thing?
Quite possibly, yeah. There was a guy on YouTube who used to do really intelligent football videos with all sorts of random clips, nicely soundtracked. And that was one, I think it's called the art of the Quick Free Kick. I don't know. Something like that.
I used to own a VHS called Lightning Strikes 95, which has aged me a little bit. There's a free kick on that, if you can track it down, where...
What's a VHS, Seb?
It was this sort of... actually, when you describe it literally, it does sound quite silly now. You know, big sort of blocky thing that you shoved into your television and, play video. It's fun.
Play pictures.
There was a free kick, and this is not going to be the very best audio anecdote, but we'll give it a go. And the taker goes back to the ball as if to replace it and to re-spot it. He bends down and Everybody just turns off. He flicks it over the wall, and a teammate's run beyond it and volleys it in. It's one of the best strict free kicks I've ever seen.
Who did that, though?
I don't know. It would have been, had I known that we were going to go in stretch, I would have prepared this.
Go and watch Lightning Strikes 95.
If you can find, it probably costs about a grand on eBay now.
I'm sure someone will have stuck it
online. It's legendary.
Loads of old stuff from the 90s is online. Some good, some bad.
I mean, we should just point out that Kevin De Bruyne, since the start of last season, he's on 32 assists in all competitions, is 8 more than any other Premier League player. And he's barely played for about what seems like that period.
Conor Bradley is catching him up, though, so watch this space.
Now, that's enough about Man City, because we have got to talk Luton.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Alfie Doughty's corner. Plenty to aim for. Towards the front post, he's headed in! Elijah Radebayo has his match ball! Absolutely magical!
Tuesday, Luton 4, Brighton nothing. A Kenny Rogering, I'm calling it. Of course, it was Brighton who beat Luton 4-1 on their Premier League debut back in August. Now the Hatters, 6 months later, handing that back with interest, with their best Premier League result yet. How were they so on it? How were the Seagulls so off it? What happened?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Luton have seen that you can kind of get about Brighton because they do take lots of risks in their build-up
play.
They
didn't even have time to take a risk. They were two goals down within 3 minutes.
They did, but I mean, it kind of came from Luton just sort of kind
pressing
of
the central area every
rushing
time.
Them, right. And like pressing them in a very kind of courageous way. Mm. And I think when Luton play at home in particular, they feel sort of emboldened that they can kind of take matches by the jugular. And every now and again, this happens to Brighton. You know, the 5-1 at home to Everton at the end of last season, the six goals they shipped at Villa Park. Mm. You know, this insistence on playing in this particular way on the front foot with a very high defensive line, every now and again, it just doesn't quite work and teams exploit that. And yeah, I mean, that's pretty much what Luton did. And you know, Luton do have players who are, you know, capable of, you know, causing problems for a team like Brighton. And I think when Luton came up, there was a lot of talk of what a kind of a direct team they were. They play with two big centre forwards and, you know, they've got a little stadium and it's going to be, you know, a real ordeal for visiting teams. And there's a degree of that. But they're a more sophisticated team than that, Luton. I watched their game at Burnley a little while ago. And obviously the narrative around Burnley is, they like to keep it on the deck and knock it around. And Luton played much better football than Burnley in that game. It was the one that finished 1-1 with that slightly controversial late goal that was awarded against Burnley. But they're a really good football team, Luton. It isn't just up and at them.
Rob Edwards is a very progressive manager. Yeah. He hasn't gone into Luton and done what some managers do. It's like, this is the way I play and change stuff. He's gone, this squad is good at this, I'm going to carry on doing that, but then add my own tweaks. It's kind of, he's shown respect to the Premier League, which I would say Burnley haven't. Burnley have just come up and gone, well, this worked last season, and it doesn't work this season.
Yeah, but I mean, like, Ross Barkley is one of the signings of the season. Mm. Got another assist last night.
Yep.
Doughty and Ogbeni are two of the most dynamic wing backs around. Adebayo is in a great run of form. Obviously got the hat trick against Brighton on Tuesday.
He's on 6 goals in 7. And talking about signings, they picked him up from Walsall for 250k. Remarkable stuff.
Yeah, I mean, because he started at Fulham, so kind of, you know, his talent was flagged early on, but then, you know, went out on a series of loans. And yeah, now he's banging them in the Premier League. And you look at the Premier League table and all of a sudden there's a little bit of a gap to Burnley and Sheffield United, who are looking increasingly doomed. Luton are now out of the bottom three. They've still got a game in hand on Everton. Obviously, we await the outcome of this Everton appeal. But, you know, they look and have looked for a little while now like the most likely of the three promoted teams to really make a fist of transfer.
Some people were bravely saying that back in the summer, but yeah.
Well, they were also saying that Chelsea were which is, you know.
It's cherry picking your memories.
No, but it's
there,
all about courage, isn't it? Mm. You know?
Yeah. Even a stopped clock. twice a day.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
The Hatters going 2-0 up after 2 minutes and 17 seconds is the second fastest that a 2-0 lead has ever been established in a Premier League game. Duncan, what's the fastest? Who would be that?
Leicester v Derby in April 1998,
really?
Which I'm sure is burned into all our consciousnesses.
Wow. How quickly did they go 2-0 up?
Even quicker.
Yeah. Nice.
But it's... Yeah, Luton are... I think anyone that's sort of watched Luton a lot in other divisions might struggle to say heartwarming in some respects, but they are... I think the teams that come up from the Championship, like Brentford and Brighton, that come and do something memorable, I think they really sort of sear themselves onto the consciousness of the nation, and Luton are doing that.
Hmm. I thought their football against Brighton was really smart, because like when you talk about a team that are going to break quickly and counter... I think most people kind of reduce that to sit on the edge of your box and wait for your chance to just to throw players forward. Whereas in reality, you watch them kind of pincer in on loose passes. In like I think it's the third goal where, you know, for probably the fifth time in the first half, Brighton play a wayward pass inside. And you see how quickly all of those players react. They all know their role. They all know how to exploit the space going forward. I mean, the reverse of that is there be the kind of the perils of being a fundamentalist coach, not thinking this isn't working for us because our confidence isn't there, so let's maybe shift away from our internal players. But
so De Zerbi, whose name was mentioned in a lot of articles talking about the post-Klopp Liverpool, what it might look like, he's...
Even Barcelona, Jimbo, I've heard that over the past few weeks. I don't know if they could afford to employ him, but I've heard it.
Well, his Seagulls side have now won just 3 Premier League games since September. Since September. They failed to score in their last 3 Premier League matches, which is... for a, you know, such a forward-thinking team, a bit extraordinary. And they've now lost their star forward, João Pedro, to injury. Don't know how long that's likely to be, but yikes. Bit of a problem there. Who have Brighton got at the weekend? Checks, notes.
Big one. The biggie.
It's the Crystal Palace.
The big fixture.
The Peace Pottage Trophy, yeah.
Nice. While Luton will be visiting Newcastle, who they beat, actually, at Kenilworth Road back in December. But this is... up north, and Newcastle suddenly back and banging. At least they were at Aston Villa on Tuesday when they went there and they won 3-1. Their first home defeat, Aston Villa, since the 18th of February 2023. And the Magpies had a rubbish run in the Premier League of late and hadn't, I think they'd only had one away win so far this season. But the strange thing about this was how easy it looked for Newcastle.
It was baffling. I haven't seen much of Villa over the past few weeks, but a game that you kind of have circled, that's going to be a great game. And so you can highlight Fabian Schär's 2 goals and the set pieces, but it was amazing how easily a big diagonal worked for Newcastle time after time. Like the amount of space that Anthony Gordon had on the left, and even before they took the lead, Newcastle could have been 2 or 3 up. It just looked disorganised. It was also, they looked like a side who hadn't prepared for what they were about to face, which is these breaking players, and Gordon's threat is pretty obvious, and it was chaotic.
Which is interesting, because the same thing happened on the opening day, and obviously this set of fixtures was the reverse of the opening day, and we're actually putting a piece out tomorrow on The Athletic, which is kind of looking back at the opening day and then looking at these fixtures and going, oh, look, some teams have learnt, some have changed, some have adapted, blah, blah, blah. And it was weird because often, you know, look at Luton, they really have changed since the opening day and that game against Brighton. But Villa were just the same. It was like, you know, they should stop watching Lightning Strikes 95 and start watching August 23 because they hadn't learned any lessons.
It actually, it looked like it belonged. Do you remember that sequence of games sort of before and after Christmas where all these teams that previously had defended quite well were being exposed in bizarre ways. Like they just defended terribly. That was, teams were able to kind of play two or three pretty fundamental balls up the pitch, and then there'd be all this space that just doesn't belong on a Premier League pitch. It felt like Villa's moment to experience that. It would be pretty disheartening if you're a Villa fan, I think.
Mm. Just one win in five games now in the league for Unai Emery's side. The game that we have, well, there's two games we haven't really mentioned. One is the Everton-Fulham clash. Fulham-Everton.
46 shots.
Really?
And it finished 0-0.
46 shots?
46. I think Fulham had 25 and Everton had 21.
XG, right. Duncan?
Well, Everton this season, again, because it was on the opening day, they didn't score. They've had nearly 5 XG against Fulham this season and not scored. So, given their situation, that could be costly come May.
Mm.
And Fulham basically either beat you 5-0 at home or don't score any goals. It's 5 or nothing. That's the choice.
The other game that took place in round 22, or has taken place so far, because we've got those two others coming up Thursday night, West Ham, Bournemouth and Wolves, Man United, it was the quite remarkable Crystal Palace, Sheffield United. Woof. From Ben Berrettan-Diaz in the first 30 seconds. This one had all the lightning strikes you could wish for. Lightning strikes 5 times.
Lightning did strike a lot. I really, really enjoy watching Eze and Elise play together. Mm. They're just fabulous footballers.
Doesn't happen often, though.
It doesn't, and this is kind of part of the problem. Like I think you must be kind of mired in existential crisis as a Palace fan, because you have these gifted players, and yet your overarching strategy is to what? Really, what is the direction of the club? What is your... I think if you're a supporter, it's pretty easy to tolerate everything if there is a sense of progress towards a point in the future. Even if you don't get there, there's a sort of a model. We're going to be this club. Yeah, or like an aspiration. Yeah. Vague aspiration. And at Palace, you just think the moment Roy Hodgson stayed, and no disrespect to him, but given where he is in his career, what that represented, you just think, What am I doing as a fan? What am I investing in emotionally? Where are we progressing towards? And so into that context come two really gifted players who play with, at their best, not only a very talented technically, but just have a sort of an exuberance and a kind of an ambition with the ball that is just so much fun to watch.
And also, I mean, when you are very dependent on two attacking players who are injured quite a lot, it's just night and day. I mean, you look at some of Palace's recent results, some of Palace's recent performances, the doom and gloom, the kind of fan protests, shipping 5 goals at Arsenal. But when you've got Eze and Elise in the team and they're on song, I mean, they're two of the most exciting attacking players in the Premier League. And I mean, I sort of understand people's frustrations with Hodgson and this sense that, that the club isn't evolving. But if you can get Eze and Elise on the pitch more often than not, then, you will get performances like that, and you will get more victories than you will without them, which is very difficult to sort of allow leeway for their potential absences, because they're kind of irreplaceable.
Do you think that would increase your frustration as a supporter, though? Because you... In Palace's position, that you're going to have Eze and Elise for a certain period of time before inevitably someone comes and cherry picks them. Mm. And so whilst you're sustained by their performance at the time, there's also this nagging feeling of let's put something around them and let's use this moment to potentially infiltrate the top half or make a run at a cup. It feels like it's both sides of that coin.
I see what you mean, but also they did have Wilf Zaha for about a decade, which everyone said every year he was going to do that, and he never did. And I don't think that's going to be the case with Eze and Elise. But I guess it's the sort of eternal
conundrum
of being
a
mid-table Premier League team. It's like,
when do you cash in?
The
what
Alan
Kerbishley
conundrum.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Palace play Brighton on Saturday. Woof.
Interesting to see the Premier League just called Ben Brereton-Diaz Ben Brereton on the tweet.
Not having his
heartwarming Chilean backstory, but fair enough.
Already.
What's he got on the back of his shirt? He's got Brereton-Diaz on the back of his shirt, hasn't he? Yeah, he's rebranded.
They refer to him as Brereton-Diaz in the commentary. Mm. So,
well, you would, wouldn't you?
I suppose so, but then what's the... Do you have an edict around that kind of thing, or does that come from the player?
Very 90s sort of player, and he feels... essence of sort of Paul Warhurst, yeah, or even Matt Janssen for a few younger listeners.
When players decide to have their first name on the back of their shirts rather than their surname for personal reasons, do we have to then refer to them by their first name?
The whole situation has become incredibly lax because
very
Hasselbank, when he moved to Leeds, wanted Jimmy on the back, and they were like, no. But now you can,
you get all sorts. I mean, Nunez has got Darwin on the back of his shirt, which is a slightly more distinctive name than Jimmy. Nunez, but those of us with common surnames, Darwin, you know, I'm afraid you just don't get the choice.
Move over, Darwin. Yeah. So anyway, Palace playing Brighton on Saturday, Everton Spurs on Saturday, which is going to be Richarlison's first appearance at Goodison since he left 18 months ago. Ooh. What else? You got Newcastle, Luton, Burnley, Fulham, and at 5:30 on Saturday, Sheffield United, Villa. Sunday at 2:00, there are three games: Chelsea, Wolves. Chelsea have a rotten record against Wolverhampton Wanderers. They've only won one of the last seven meetings. They've already lost them once this season. You got Bournemouth, Forest, and at the other game at 2:00 is Man United, West Ham, which is the televised one. David Moyes has never won away at Old Trafford as a visiting manager, not that often as a home one neither. So, yeah, but it might happen this time around. We shall see.
Not a bad time to be going to Old Trafford, having not won there for a while, as Bournemouth and Brighton and just about every other team who's played there this season can testify.
Yeah. Wolves coming up before that, of course, for United on Thursday evening. Very good. After this, we will part the Premier League stuff and talk about Africa Cup of Nations.
We're sponsored for this episode of the Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. It's your perfect teammate, the Sutton to your Shearer, the Heskey to your Owen, the Mane and Firmino to your Salah. Whether you're selling I Belong to Jimbo t-shirts or Max and Barry half and half scars, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to the Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show with James Richardson, the Football Content Awards International Podcast of the Year.
AFCON talk coming up very shortly. Also in the quarterfinals, though, is the other big international tournament currently underway. And yes, it's the Asian Cup, which Friday is going to see Tajikistan face Jordan, yeah, and Australia take on South Korea, big one. The winners of those two games will meet in the first semi-final on Tuesday. Wednesday's second semi-final will pair the victors of Saturday's quarterfinal games, which are, Seb, Iran-Japan, and host Qatar against Uzbekistan. So we're still on for an Australia or South Korea against Iran or Japan final, which will be big, legitimately. Final Saturday the 10th, you know. Anyway, Asian Cup tick. Did you want to talk about Roberto Mancini storming off? Because that's the bit I think everyone's seen
at
the Asian Cup.
Yeah.
Saudi Arabia going out to South Korea on penalties, having been, 30 seconds away from actually winning the game in normal time. And as the South Korean player steps up to take what proved the winning penalty, what's this? Saudi Arabia manager Roberto Mancini walking casually off down the tunnel. I'm not going to stick around to watch the end of this
and
game.
And saying in the aftermath that he thought it was over.
Yeah.
I need that. I need an extra layer of explanation for that, I think. I don't see how anyone could make that mistake.
Mancini's thrown a huff at the end of games before, but famously when he was at Inter. It's extraordinary. And to say, as you know, with the barefaced effrontery to say, I, as a football manager who's experienced countless penalty shootouts, literally don't know when they finish, because it's not as if there's usually a big roar or nothing like that. Yeah, remarkable.
Also, he's set for quite a creditable result. Because I would favour South Korea in that game. I think I was surprised it went to penalties. You're in a good position. And regardless of the outcome there, where does the huff and the tantrum come from? Have we heard any
I don't know. Maybe he just completely lost interest.
He just got bored. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, it makes more sense to leave before the end of a defeat than before a victory. I'm trying to think about precedent of managers leaving the dugout before the end of the game. Sturrock, and the first one that comes to mind is Jose Mourinho, doing his handshake.
Sturrock was just looking for an egg bap, though.
With the opposition bench. I can kind of understand how you might not want to see the moment of defeat. But you nonetheless should. I mean, that's what sport is.
But it's a penalty shootout. You could still win.
But you come back, don't you?
Italians. Yeah.
Not a great show of faith in his goalkeeper, if anything else.
Yeah, if the South Korean penalty hadn't gone in, they were still in it.
Well, he could come back out. I don't think it's not a one way. Yeah. I mean, Maurizio Sarri nearly stormed off in the Carabao Cup final when Kepa had a second, but then a bit like when you're a kid and you storm out of your house and you're like,
quite cold out here and I'm hungry and I don't think so.
All right, definitely not cold out in Côte d'Ivoire, from whence we are joined by Maher Mazahi. Hi, Maher.
Good morning. Good afternoon. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good. Where are you, Maher?
I'm in Abidjan. Today is the second day of our days off in between the round of 16 and the quarterfinals. So there are some press conferences that I refuse to go to. My main mission for the day today is going to be trying to find a pool or maybe drive 30 minutes out to Grand Bassam and go to the beach.
Okay. Knowing you, though, it will be a pool with some incredible cultural significance or a beach with historical resonance. What have you got cooked up for these 2 days off?
So yesterday I napped 3 times and then today's swimming and tomorrow is back to football.
Okay.
People don't realize, I think, how intense the African Cup of Nations can be when you're covering it, just from especially for a journalist that tries to cover the entirety of the teams.
Right.
There's a lot of traveling, there's a lot of press conferences, a lot of things to write. So you try to capitalize on those rest days when you can.
Absolutely. And we talked in our first chat about this AFCON about the distances involved there in Côte d'Ivoire. And you've been up and down the country. I imagine right now, even as you head off to cool down at a pool or a beach, that the atmosphere must be getting hotter and hotter with Ivory Coast safely through to the quarterfinals.
It's electric. It's really palpable. It's difficult to describe the national mood and spirit prior to that match against Senegal in the round of 16, where Cote d'Ivoire advanced on penalties after playing to a 1-1 draw in regular time. And the pre and the post result of that match, it's very difficult to describe. You have to be here to feel it. And now they play against Mali, their neighbors to the north, in the quarterfinals in Bouaké. And Bouaké is that city that we've spoken about before in this podcast, where, you know, it was the stronghold of the rebels during the Civil War, and it very much became a symbol of unity after the Civil War, because that's where they signed the peace accords. The stadium itself is where they have this huge peaceful ceremony, and the stadium is named Stade de la Paix, you know, the stadium of peace. And so for the national team to be traveling there now to play this match against Mali, I think is very, very fitting.
Mm. Prior to the Senegal game, they got beaten. Who beat them 4-0?
Equatorial Guinea beat them 4-0 in the Bimpe.
And they fired their manager as a result. So as you say, very different kind of feeling going into it to the one as they approach this derby essentially now with Mali. That's one of the quarterfinals coming up Friday and Saturday. 8 teams involved, none of whom were in the quarterfinals of the last AFCON, which kind of speaks to the unpredictable nature of this tournament.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you hit the nail on the head. I think very few people were expecting Cape Verde or Angola to have the tournaments that they did. Or even Guinea, I think, is a little bit surprising despite the quality of their squad on paper. I don't think many people were expecting them to make it this far, or this might just be their limit here. It also, I think, speaks to the depth of talent across the continent. You know, countries like Cape Verde or Equatorial Guinea have done a great job of sort of mining into their diaspora in Portugal or Spain. And that's been a credit to them. And they've known how to capitalize on those resources. So, the African Cup of Nations is becoming more and more competitive. And I think CAF have justified their decision to make this an expanded tournament with 24 teams now.
Okay. So Friday, you got Nigeria against the lowest ranked team still in the competition, Angola, and Democratic Republic of Congo against Guinea, and then Saturday, Mali against Ivory Coast, and Cape Verde against South Africa, who put out Morocco, the World Cup semi-finalist. Are we going to see more upsets? What would be an upset? What are you most looking forward to in those quarterfinals?
I think the one upset that we might see is Cape Verde might get past South Africa. There are two sides that play similar football, I think. Maybe the two sides that play the most technical football left in this tournament. They both like to play the ball out from the back very well. Cape Verde are averaging 54% possession, South Africa 49%. Cape Verde have the second most goals in the tournament, and South Africa concede the second least amount of goals with just two. I think that's the main difference, is that despite the fact that they play similar kinds of football, the end product is very different. Cape Verde have been scoring more than we expect them to, and South Africa have been conceding less than we expect them to. But I think when these two sides line up, it's going to be a very, very tight match. And I think Cape Verde just have a little more quality going forward. South Africa are missing Lyle Foster from Burnley and Lebo Matiba, their other striker. So I do think Cape Verde have a little more attacking quality, and that could make the difference.
Maher, all of the North African teams have gone out, and traditionally they tend to struggle when the AFCON takes place in sub-Saharan Africa. Why do you think that is? What are the factors at play there?
Well, it's an interesting one. Usually we draw a difference between Egypt and the Maghreb. When I talk about the Maghreb, I mean, you know, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia. Egypt have had success in what we call, you know, in quotes, sub-Saharan Africa. They won the 2008 tournament and the 2010 tournament there recently. And people think that that's the case because Egypt play, you know, the majority of their players are composed of their domestic league, teams like Al Ahly or Zamalek, and they get to play, you know, the Champions League or the Confederation Cup on the continent. And so they're therefore more used to traveling on the continent. They're more used to the climatic conditions, whereas the teams from the Maghreb, tend to be more composed of players from the diaspora, players that aren't used to traveling and playing on the continent. I think it's a pretty pertinent observation, even though Egypt were knocked out just as quickly as the rest of the North African teams this time around. Me personally, when I sit back and think, I don't want to say that it's just because they're from the north of the continent. I think it's a little bit of a lazy observation. When I look at it on a case-to-case basis, I think that the North African teams were outdone by poor coaching this time around. Morocco had the best coaching of the North African nations, but Walid Regragui, the coach, he admitted in the post-match press conference that he made a mistake in the way he approached South Africa. Prior to the tournament, we were talking a lot about Morocco out of possession versus in possession. At the World Cup, they played so well out of possession, and we were wondering, you know, how they would do when they are forced to take the onus and break down the opposing team. And so what he did in the biggest match of the tournament is he did the opposite. He gave South Africa the ball, and he just sat back in a sort of medium to low block, especially throughout the first half. And South Africa made them pay for it because South Africa have such great chemistry. They have 8.5 players that come from Mamelodi Sundowns, 8 plus Percy Tau, who came from Mamelodi Sundowns but is not currently playing for them. And so what they did is they have great team chemistry, and they would find these half spaces, and they combined so well. And it was one of those moves where Morocco didn't do anything wrong defensively, but South Africa were just so quick, and they could read each other's minds so quickly, and they scored a goal. And then after that, Morocco started chasing the game, and that's when they got caught out on a counterattack. So Regragui had the wrong game plan against South Africa, and then I'll be very brief just to say Algeria, Tunisia, and Egypt, the coaching was very, very subpar, especially Tunisia.
Where are you going to be heading for the quarterfinals, Maher?
I'm going to watch Angola versus Nigeria. It's going to be in Felicia here in Abidjan. I love that stadium. You know, at nightfall, there's a bunch of bats that come and circle around the stadium. It's very, very scenic, and they're screeching, and it sort of adds to the percussive soundtrack of the stadium. Nigeria are now the bookies' favorites, but wow. Angola are in a unique position where they haven't been here in a while. And they really identify... Angolans identify with this team because... they play with something called Ginga. That's what it was described to me as, which is a sort of flair that they have in Angola. And for those that don't know, Angola went through a brutal civil war from the 1970s to the early 2000s. And what happened was you had a huge exodus from the rural areas, and people would move to Luanda, the capital city. And in this sort of hyper-urbanization, there's a lot of mixing of cultures and styles. And I guess that produced a lot of skillful, flair footballers. And then even the youngness of this team, you know, a lot of them are composed of the under 17 team that went to the FIFA World Cup under 17 tournament in 2019. And the way they listen to, you know, the I forget the name of the Angolan house music, but they'll dance to it and they'll sing to it. And I think they just, a lot of people, you know, after living under that communist regime for so long, felt like they were being repressed in so many different areas. And this Angolan team and football in general was sort of used as a way to express yourself, you know, not just football, but also the arts like music as well. So the fact that Angola are playing and are playing with this much flair, it really speaks to a lot of Angolans. And I think that there's something special happening there. But I still think Nigeria are going to win.
Okay, well, that'll be the game which kicks off the quarterfinals there at the Felicia Stadium with the Bats and you, Maher. And well, we look forward to catching up with you next week and finding out how all of that goes.
Thank you. It would be a real pleasure to speak to you guys again.
Oh, Maher is so good.
So good.
Encyclopedia.
It's so rare. It's so long since you and I have been able to say Maher is so good.
Hey, we're gonna have to keep that in there. What? Thanks, leave me from this. I understand the hair going on. It's like
anyway, listener.
Maher is nailing his days off. I've never covered an Africa Cup of Nations, but I know from covering major tournaments, it is so exhausting.
Yeah,
and you have to really embrace those days off.
Embrace the days off,
like aggressive loafing, right. Ideally.
All right,
kind of what you want from a tournament, though, isn't it? That the kind of the rhythm of it is so attritional that you need your days on the beach.
Do you feel that way about a football season? You know, when you.
No, because there are always days off during the football season. But like in a World Cup or a European Championship or whatever, like the first like 2 weeks is just so full on. And then you get to the knockout rounds, a bit more time for, you know, sightseeing and
Do you remember that section in All Played Out where Pete Davis gets towards the end of the tournament and he has kind of just a moment in his hotel room where he's sweating and just falls asleep?
Had he drunk too much coffee?
No, I don't think so. I think he just
every day. Basically, every chapter is I had my 11th.
He had his coffee and he didn't get more than like 2 hours sleep. But he reached about the quarterfinal stage, and that was it. His body just gave up. And that kind of, I grew up with that as the sort of the archetypal tournament experience.
So when did you read that book?
I read it first.
I'm thinking from the context of England and English football now. It's from another galaxy.
Yeah,
really.
I suppose I read it. I can't remember when I first read it, but I read it for a second time, probably around 2000. I think I might be wrong.
At the time, I thought it was a fabulous read and kind of spoke to me in so many ways. Yeah. Now I wonder how well it stood up. I read it back in like
it's fabulous. It's still absolutely brilliant. It's kind of it also because you come to the game 20, 30 years later as a journalist. It does make you kind of long for a slightly different era in terms of your access. Like there's a chapter where he's dealing with the England players and they're a bit surly because of the criticism back home and stuff. And it's a tournament experience which probably doesn't exist for the media anymore.
But this was Pete Davis, who was embedded essentially with England for the 1990 Italia 90 World Cup.
Journos did not like him as well. There's a little bit of simmering tension between him and the England press corps, which is quite
What an England team that was, and what a campaign it was. And Pete, rather cleverly, through his use of being all played out, draws strong parallels with the experience of England as a nation off the pitch.
Very clever.
Anyway, that's today's Totally Football Show, unless there's any other books that Duncan and Tom would like to talk about.
Well, the other great one from that tournament was the Bill Buford one, Among the Thugs, where he ends up in Sardinia, where it all kicks off ahead of the Netherlands game, which is one of the most... I mean, people know that stuff happened that day, but from someone that was actually on the ground, it was pretty extraordinary.
Was it? Mm.
There was a documentary series that came out not that long ago about England's experience at the 1990 World Cup, and there was a lot about the thuggery in there, and it was, you know, quite an entertaining watch.
Indeed.
Obviously, it doesn't tug on the heartstrings for me quite as much as it does for you guys, I guess.
But you're an England fan by then, weren't you?
I was actually, I was well remembered, I knew no better. I was only 6 years old. It was all new to me.
Very good. That's it for today's Totally Football Show. It being Thursday, we won't be back with you until Sunday night, Monday morning, reviewing round 23 of the Premier League season and things. Do join us for that. Many thanks for your participation today, listener. And also to Seb Stafford-Bloor and to Duncan Alexander and Tom Williams and Charlie and Liam in the booth. Have a great weekend. Enjoy your day off, listener. We'll speak to you soon.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Discover bonus video content by searching for The Totally Football Show on YouTube and see the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.